We could talk to the animals. Just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee.
This is Animals Today, featuring discussions about domestic pets, wild animals, and encouraging compassion and respect for all living creatures. Live from Palm Springs, here's Dr. Lori Kirshner.
Study every creature's language so I could speak to all of them on sight. If friends said, can he talk a crab or maybe pelican? You'd say like hell he can, and you'd be right. So if you just stop and think of it, there ain't no doubt of it. I'm gonna win a place in history. A man who walks with the animals, talks with the animals, grunts and squeaks and squawks with the animals. And they could squeak and squawk and speak and talk to me.
Here, kitty kitty. Today I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner, and another beautiful sunny day here in Palm Springs, California. Second sunny day after a week or two of rain. And on a not so pleasant note, the devastation in Haiti is really unlike anything we've seen in recent years, isn't it? Probably one of the worst disasters of modern times. Tens of thousands of humans have perished. Some are estimating the death toll to be well over 200,000 human lives, and an estimated 1.5 million without homes now. We have seen for the past 12 days or so the devastating videos and stories illustrating the degree of the loss and trauma and the thousands of bodies they're still finding dead buried under the collapsed buildings. It's just so hard to view, isn't it? Our hearts and prayers go out to these poor people of Haiti. People all around the world have come together to raise millions of dollars to help provide emergency relief to the victims. Efforts focused in trying to provide emergency services, including food and water, shelter, medical services, as well as assistance, rebuilding, infrastructure, and communications, which is so complicated by the fact that this nation is considered to be the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere, with an already deficient infrastructure and only the barest of essentials of medical care to begin with. And undoubtedly and unfortunately, we will likely see, as in any major disaster like this, the outbreak of disease from contaminated water and broken sewer systems. We also see the incredible individuals, the rescue workers from our wonderful country working so hard to save lives. In addition, the amazing search and rescue dogs on the grounds in Haiti, these dogs being so essential in so many, if not most, of these rescues. So during the past couple weeks, humanitarian efforts and the human victims of the disaster are the primary concern, and the animals are not often on people's minds. Forget about them. And there are people that are concerned about the suffering of the animals in Haiti, and there are people that want to try to offer organizations are willing and wait to help the animal victims unless the animal needs are more fully met. There's very little information, at least what I could find at this point, about the impact of the disaster on the animals. No one really seems to have a clue as to how many, and as with many impoverished countries, Haiti has a lot of farm animals and strays. According to the ASPCA, there are an estimated 5 million head of livestock in the country, mostly goats. A large stray dog population, an untold number of companion animals, and native wildlife, all adversely affected by the earthquake. So you can only assume that among the rubble and hiding or buried under the collapsed structures, there are likely to be thousands of frightened, hungry, and wounded animals that are in need of some help in order to survive. And of course, every day that goes by without an opportunity to try to help them, the chance of these suffering and hurt and starving animals surviving becomes less and less. And as I mentioned, there does seem to be a coalition of groups that exists and are ready to go in and help when they can to address the needs of the animals who are in desperate need of food, water, and rabies vaccinations. And their efforts will be very much complicated by the fact that there's no animal shelters or organized animal welfare groups in this country. And there are no veterinary schools or trained animal care providers in this country either. And another concern that we all should have that must be addressed is the illnesses that might pass between animals and humans. So for the past 12 days, you turn on the TV, you listen to the news, we hear about Haiti, we see what these people have endured, the loss of lives, the now orphaned children, the survivors that lost everything, and it's hard to even imagine what these people are going through. But we should not forget about the animals. Animals are victims of catastrophes just as humans are. Animals are living beings that can also suffer, can also feel fear, can also feel pain, and they also need water and food in order to survive. And that's my point. And my other very important point I want to stress here is that disasters can happen at any time. So at least make sure you know how to protect your own animals or pets by preparing for a disaster before it strikes. You can log on to any of the National Animal Welfare Organization's websites. Most of them have a disaster preparedness page, and it will tell you exactly what to do and how to prepare in the event of a man-made or natural disaster. Remember, the key to surviving a disaster for you and your pets is to be as prepared as possible before the emergency strikes. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. This is Animals Today on News Talk 920 KPSI. And we have a great show planned for you today. One of the most recognized figures in animal behavior, Dr. Nicholas Dodman, is joining us this hour on Animals Today. Dr. Dodman appeared several months ago on the show speaking about feline social behavior, and today will be all about dogs. In particular, compulsive disorders of dogs and the influence of underlying medical problems on dogs' behavior. Dr. Dodman is director of the Animal Behavior Clinic at the Cummings School of Veterinary Medical School at Tufts University. He lectures widely, makes frequent TV and radio appearances, and has previously published 5 books. He also is a researcher, and he's the lead author of a recent paper in Molecular Psychiatry concerning the genetics of compulsive disorders in dogs. Welcome back to the program, Nick.
Hi, Laurie. It's good to be here.
Nick, we're going to talk about the very common condition of canine compulsive disorder. Would you please start by defining to the listeners canine compulsive disorder and telling us how frequently you see it in your practice?
Well, these behaviors are all repetitive disorders that, on first glance, and what was formerly thought, is they're repetitive, pointless behaviors that are really completely mindless, so serve no obvious function, and in some cases are detrimental, obviously physically to the animal. They were in fact formerly known as stereotypies, which is this mindless pacing and so on that you see in zoo animals. But then it became more apparent that actually there was a genetic basis, and in fact they are a response to anxiety. They represent continuously occurring thoughts, if you believe animals think, which I happen to, which is an obsession, followed by acting out on that thought, which is the action end of the behavior, is the compulsion. So when you see a dog, say, chasing its tail, not just once or twice out of fun, but mindlessly going around and round in circles, sometimes not even stopping to eat for hours on end, there is a thought process behind that that's originating from anxiety, and the behavior may even serve some kind of coping mechanism. We see these behaviors, to answer the second part of your question, in about 5% of the patients we see, although I have heard a figure as high as 8% of the canine population is affected by them.
Wow. Nick, is canine compulsive disorder analogous to obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, in humans?
Yes, it is. And, through the 1980s, I was looking at it, and I was calling it stereotypy. And it wasn't until 1991/1992 when a very smart, intelligent lady psychiatrist at the National Institute of Health, a woman called Dr. Judy Rappaport, after she had written a book, a New York Times bestseller called The Boy Who Could Not Stop Washing, because she's a pediatric psychiatrist, when she got home after her national book tour, she found all these messages saying, "My dog does this too. My dog does this too." And instead of, smart woman that she is, instead of saying, "Oh, nonsense, how could an animal possibly have a human problem?" She said, "I'm going to look into this." And when she did, she found out that the dogs responded in exactly the same way, to the same extent, over the same time course as humans to anti-obsessional medications, and concluded that it was an animal version of human obsessive-compulsive disorder. And it became very fashionable to talk about that particular model, which was called acral lick dermatitis, or lick granuloma, as a model. But, you know, what I did was there's another kind of broader definition called obsessive-compulsive spectrum disorders. And if you look at it in that light, as I did through the 1990s, it's not just the hand-washing thing that has a parallel. It's all of them have this fundamental similarity. And sometimes the canine ones don't look exactly like the human ones, but the actual mechanism inside the animal is exactly the same. And they all respond to the same kind of medications. They all arise out of anxiety. And, you know, I wrote several book chapters for psychiatry books and psychiatry journals explaining this, and the work was sort of widely acclaimed. And that kind of took us up to 2000 when we started our quest for the gene.
Now, you mentioned tail chasing and acral lick dermatitis. I want to talk about some of these specific behaviors you commonly see. What is acral lick dermatitis?
Well, acral literally means the lower extremities of the legs. And so if you translate acral lick dermatitis, lower extremity of the leg being licked, resulting in dermatitis. So stripping of hair, inflammation of skin, ulceration of skin, sometimes big, deep, crater-like ulcers that eventually, in trying to heal, they kind of fill up with granulation tissue, which is kind of strawberry-like in texture. And so you've got this pink granulating mass, so sometimes called lick granuloma. It's very classical where it affects the dog. It's usually on the wrist and the front leg, and on the hock, and sort of back ankle on the back leg. And if it doesn't occur in those two locations, then it probably isn't this condition. I mean, for example, if a dog is licking between his toes, he's probably got an allergy.
Yeah. And you think this stems from anxiety versus, let's say, boredom that causes anxiety?
Well, it's a chicken and an egg, really. If I see a dog like this, there's certain breeds, you know, it's typically large dogs over 50 pounds, represented particularly by dogs like Labradors, Golden Retrievers, Great Danes, Dobermans, these kind of large breed dogs. And when I see them, they're usually sort of middle-aged, sometimes even a little bit older, you know, maybe sort of 7 or 8 or 9, and, or maybe 7's middle-aged. But when you would expect the dog to be calming down, they're not. They remain sort of hyper-vigilant, on edge, kind of anxious, looking, you know, kind of hyper-vigilant, looking around their environment, almost kind of like looking for trouble, just sort of very susceptible to things going on around them. So it's that kind of anxious, nervous temperament that if the dog is alone and is bored, may erupt into the compulsive licking, whereas a type B personality dog would just kind of go, you know, ho-hum, there's nothing much to do, I guess I'll go to sleep.
Right. Nick, in your book you write, in compulsive disorders, isolated aspects of predatory behavior can be expressed out of context. Can you elaborate on that idea for the listeners?
Yeah, there's a number of compulsive disorders that derive from the natural hardwired behavior of predation. So predatory behaviors, which are present in all dogs, we haven't bred that out of them. They all chase things to a greater or lesser extent, depending on their breed. So if you have a dog with very high prey drive, say a terrier is a typical example, a dog's in the terrier group, in a way, in this modern life that we live ourselves and cause them to live, they find themselves, as it were, all dressed up and no place to go. If they have this genetic susceptibility, if they have this anxious situation, if they're in the pressure cooker of life, their particular penchant, I mean, the way that they erupt into a compulsive disorder, if they're going to, is by expressing this very strong prey drive, but they're displaying it inappropriately because there is no prey around. So in the case of tail chasing, the tail becomes the prey, and out of the corner of their eye, we surmise, they see this object moving behind them, and they kind of lap around to get it, but of course it moves away, which is great because that makes it even more like prey. And then they keep doing it and doing it, and eventually it becomes hardwired into the dog and compulsive and just as expressed in situations even when there is no conflict going on. But predatory compulsions are not just confined to tail chasing. They can be snapping at imaginary flies. They can be chasing shadows around the floor, particularly common in, say, border collies and old English sheepdogs. Note herding breeds who have very high prey drive, because that's where you get herding behavior from.
Yeah.
So all that kind of stuff. There's a number of these chasing lights and shadows and imaginary things and so on. All Nick, predation.
Yeah. Nick, one of our dogs, an older Shepherd Doberman mix, who's quite calm and content, does get into this licking the fabric of the couch once in a while. We consider it slightly weird, almost a cute behavior, and he stops when we say stop. But in other dogs, it can be quite the problem. Talk about surface licking.
He's a Doberman, you say?
Doberman Shepherd mix.
Yeah. Well, you know, the study we just did was on Dobermans, and Dobermans do have this sort of oral leaning. Freud would have been delighted because they can appear like, he would have called them oral retentives. So they do this blanket sucking, blanket chewing, blanket ingesting, sucking on their flank. I mean, all kinds of oral behaviors. If they were humans, they'd probably smoke 5 packs of cigarettes a day.
That's right.
And then, you know, that could conceivably be displayed as licking or paying attention to some other kind of fabric. But having said that, let me just back off from that. When you see a dog that isn't a Doberman, just generally licking the floor or licking furniture, varnished surfaces, licking rugs, carpets, or just licking in the air, one thing to check out for as a medical ringer is gastrointestinal problems.
Oh.
So sometimes when a dog has a low-grade, we call it GI problem, gastrointestinal problem, you know, an ulcer or a kind of sort of inflamed bowel or colitis or something of that nature, they can express that behavior as licking. That's been published. So I would definitely rule out medical things. It's also remotely possible, not in the case you're telling me about, but in some dogs we have definitely suspected that partial seizures can also manifest as licking and eating inedible objects, as actually can anemia. But if we rule out all the medical ringers, licking can be a compulsive behavior. In this case, the underlying natural hardwired behavior is that percentage of compulsive disorder that is called consummatory behavior.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned the other phenomena of light chasing and shadow chasing and snapping at imaginary flies and flank sucking and blanket sucking. There's also, you mentioned, this whole other group of compulsive disorders, Nick, having to do with eating. Can you go into this a bit, compulsive eating disorders?
Yeah, actually, that's where I came in, because there I was sitting, minding my own business, not quite really, but in 1982, we end up by conducting an experiment on a horse. Now, horses are big-time eaters. They spend 60% of their day chewing on things, chewing on grass and eating whatever's around. That's how they get their food. So it's only natural that if a horse is stressed and has this anxious predisposition, it might displace into a behavior related to eating. So they do this thing called cribbing. They chomp on the edge of their barn door, actually lean in backwards and tense their neck muscles and swallow air. So that is a kind of an eating compulsive disorder, and that's how I got into actually behavior, period, and possibly the reason why my burning interest these days continues to be compulsive disorders. But dogs can do them too, and cats, because eating is so fundamental. Any hardwired behavior, including eating, you know, appetitive behavior, consummatory behavior, can be expressed compulsively, mindlessly, repetitively, you know, misdirected. It could be, you know, I've seen Rottweilers just sitting there on the ground, just licking nothing, you know, in space, licking and swallowing, tongue playing in some animals, particularly in horses, ingestion of inedible materials. In some cases, I think it can be expressed as compulsive overeating, and I believe in humans too. Some unfortunate people just, you know, there's a constant thought that they need to eat some more, and the fulfillment is to go and do it. And if they don't eat, they feel anxious, and if they do eat as frequently as their recurring thought tells them, they end up overweight, and that's unhelpful. So I think the same thing applies to animals. You can end up with cats that are, you know, as big as a dinner plate and weigh about 25 pounds, and dogs. I mean, I had a Labrador retriever that inside should have weighed like 75 pounds, but the actual dog weighed 150 with a 75-pound dog inside trying to get out.
So sad. Nick, so in this group of compulsive eating disorders you mentioned in your book, stool eating and stone or rock chewing and dirt eating and grass, is grass, my dogs eat a lot of grass. Is that a normal or is that considered compulsive eating disorder?
Yeah, I hadn't even gotten around to that. There's so many of these things, but stone chewing, you're absolutely right. Yes, I did write about that, and chewing bark and mulch and stuff. And some grass is not so typical for a compulsive disorder. I've seen, first of all, grass eating is a normal behavior in dogs. They're kind of, they're not carnivores, as most people think. They're omnivores, and they do need elements of vegetable material. And sometimes they chew because they need fiber or whatever is in grass, the other components. Sometimes when they feel sick, they eat grass, and it's an emetic. It makes them throw up, so it can kind of go both ways. But that behavior of chewing grass, let's think about human hand washing. There's nothing wrong with eating grass or for a human washing your hands if you do it the right amount of time, you know, reasonably.
Yeah.
But once it's more than an hour a day for humans washing their hands, it's a normal behavior that's now gone awry. So grass eating, if a dog did nothing but think about eating grass and eat grass all day long and throw up and fall around, he'd either be ill or he'd have a compulsive disorder.
Please define for us pica.
Pica literally is a depraved appetite. So typically, you know, one of the medical conditions that underlies that is anemia. And I once had a dog come in to see me that they said they thought he was compulsive and he was eating every single thing in sight. I mean, there was no... you know, whatever it was on the floor, he would eat it. And eating inedible objects of whatever type. And that one of my bright students was looking at him. Dog lifted his gums and said, "Hey, Dr. Dobbin, this dog is very pale." So we took a blood count and found he had almost, run out of red cells. I mean, in fact, he had autoimmune hemolytic anemia, and that had caused him to have this pica. But pica can also be a compulsive disorder, notably in cats, where they have this condition that starts off as what they call wool sucking, and then it goes to wool ingesting, and then it goes to not strictly pica, because pica is indiscriminate eating of inedible objects, but it goes to a sort of texture-specific pica, where the cats will focus on woolen, sometimes wool / acrylic, shower curtains, shoelaces, running gear. There's a list of about 10 or 12 things that they focus their attention on, sometimes plastic coating on wires or even newspapers.
Mm. Don't go away. More with Dr. Nicholas Dodman right here on Animals Today.
Are you thinking about adding a pet to your family? Please adopt one. Don't buy one from a store or breeder. Most come from filthy, overcrowded puppy mills and are inbred and diseased. Our local shelters are overflowing with healthy, loving cats and dogs waiting for you to adopt them. Go to the internet and check out petfinder.com or pets911.com. Or, better yet, go directly to us.
Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner, and we've been speaking to Dr. Nicholas Dodman. Thanks for tuning in. I love his book, The Well-Adjusted Dog. If you own a dog, or even if you don't and want to learn more about dog behavior, you're going to just find this book so informative and interesting. And this being one of several well-known books Dr. Dodman has written. And to my local listeners, you should know that you will have the opportunity to meet Dr. Dodman in person, one of our country's most recognized figures in animal behavior, right here in Southern California. On March 26th through the 28th, Dr. Dodman will be holding two workshops in Pasadena, the Well-Adjusted Cat Workshop, Secrets to Understanding Feline Behavior, and the Well-Adjusted Dog Workshop, Secrets to Understanding Canine Behavior. Later, I'll be speaking more about Dr. Dodman's appearance in Pasadena, but you can also log on to www.thepetdocs.com to learn more about this. We've been speaking about compulsive disorders of dogs, and Nick, before we get on to your next chapter, which I want to talk to you about on the influence of underlying medical conditions on dogs' behaviors, I just have a few more questions for you about the compulsive disorders we've been talking about. Nick, one of our dogs, Susie, frequently gets into this mode where she vocalizes with each exhalation, like, It will happen when she's laying down. She's with us in a room. We are in her presence, and she seems relaxed and not worried. But what is she trying to tell us, Nick?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because my dog, Rusty, does that too.
Okay.
All the people in the last meeting, when I kept saying, and my dog, Rusty, and this dog looks a bit like Rusty, everybody, Rusty's turned into a star. I'm going to have to, he's fairly new acquisition, of course, from a shelter. I have to put him up on the website to go with all the other creatures that we have and have owned and whatever. But anyway, he does that same thing. So when he's a little bit stressed, he does that exhalation whine, and particularly if he's got something really fun and something he values so much that he's actually worrying about where he can put it, whether someone won't get it, like a special chew thing, a chew toy. And he gets it between his paws and there's this, so he does that. But I think one thing, since we're talking about compulsive disorders, just about any noise that dogs make can be expressed compulsively, up to and including barking. Just because it's a noise doesn't mean it's a compulsion. You know, dogs vocalize for any one of a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And usually it means something. You know, I'm excited,
right,
or stay away, or want to play. And people who are really good with their dogs can identify. Sometimes they're overly noisy, sometimes it's attention-seeking behavior, sometimes it's hyper-excitement, almost bordering on ADD. But sometimes, if you get the diagnosis right, it can be compulsive. And typically, like compulsive barking would just be this lonely, monotonous bark you hear in a dog who's been shut out in the yard or tied on a tether or put on a runner, and his owner's go to work for 8 hours. He's got nothing to do. He's stressed. And it's even beyond reacting to his environment. He just... In a summer afternoon, you just listen, well, here in the Northeast, and you hear this noise sometimes on the horizon, and I know there's a dog who's suffering on the other end of that noise, and that can be compulsive vocalization, just like you can have compulsive eating, just like you can have compulsive grooming, just like you can have compulsive predatory behavior. Any natural behavior can be expressed as a compulsive disorder.
And you and I both know this coalition in this grassroots coalition in Massachusetts, which has filed a bill to ban devocalization, which I know to be one of these unnecessary, cruel, mutilating, convenient surgeries. One of the things they've told me is how counterproductive it is to cut the vocal cords instead of trying to treat the underlying trigger, like separation anxiety or another compulsive behavior like you mentioned,
yeah.
And that devocalization doesn't really resolve the issue, just makes it easier for the owner to ignore. I'm glad you mentioned that, and but you do agree that it's a better way to go to just try to treat the underlying behavior versus just cutting out the vocal cords.
You know, try and understand what the dog is saying with his voice, what he means, try and supply his needs, try and retrain him. I mean, one simple trick is that if you feed a dog who barks too much out of a Kong, a stuffed Kong, I'm not just talking about peanut butter treat. I'm talking about his entire daily rations packed tightly in a Kong, maybe even damped down, maybe even frozen a bit to keep them together. If his only opportunity to eat is out of this Kong, and you've designed it by packing it in there, that it takes him an hour and a half twice a day to eat his meal, the instance of vocalization can drop by as much as 90%. If I was a dog, I'd much rather be fed from a Kong than have my throat cut. And the surgery isn't a permanent solution. There's regrowth of a web. They have to have second surgeries. They can aspirate, and some die of aspiration pneumonia. It's a mutilation that makes about as much sense as cutting off someone's hands because they steal.
Right, exactly. Thank you for stressing that. And just to tell my listeners, you mentioned Kong a few times. I just want to make sure they know what that is. K-O-N-G, it's just like a big chew toy, correct?
It's a big hard rubber chew toy.
Right.
That actually was originally developed as like one of these shock absorbers for a motorbike. Guy was working on his motorbike, and this sort of plastic rippled rubber thing fell on the floor. His dog paid it attention, so he said, hey, there's a new toy for dogs. I'll make it and call it Kong.
And now he's retired on millions.
I think so.
On balance, Nick, do dogs in America get enough mental stimulation?
No, and that was the purpose of writing The Well-Adjusted Dog, which could equally well have been entitled Dogs 101 Ownership. You know, and actually what I wanted on the front cover where they wouldn't let me have it was a picture of me with an oil can or a wrench working on a dog to adjust it correctly. They wouldn't let me do that. But, you know, in there, the chapter one is about exercise, and there's another chapter in there, I think it's number seven, about environmental enrichment. And if they get tons of exercise and fruitful things to do, mentally occupying things to do, both inside and outside the house, then you have a tired dog, a satiated dog, a good dog, and one who actually has a purpose in his life.
Tired dog is a good dog. And if a dog seems content, Nick, should I try to teach him a new trick or add extra play activities to his life?
I think so.
Okay.
Education is lifelong for us and dogs.
Yes, very good. Nick, we only have about 10 minutes left, so I want to get to your other chapter. In your book, The Well-Adjusted Dog, you have a fairly lengthy chapter on the influence of underlying medical conditions on dogs' behavior. Nick, what are the common or important clues in the behavior of a dog that would signal a high likelihood of an underlying medical condition?
Well, I always suspect it because of my veterinary background. So somebody brings me a dog with some kind of behavior problem. Just even in passing in my mind, I sort of think, I wonder if it could be medical. And then I either count it in or rule it out, or sometimes I have to do a test to do a tiebreaker. But typically, if you have some very extreme behavior, if you have some very explosive sudden onset behavior, if you have a behavior that arises in the middle of life, so a dog who's been very, say, good-tempered for 5 years of his life, and then between five and five and a half, all of a sudden he starts to act aggressively. A dog who is old, who suddenly has a change in behavior, a dog who's over 10, who suddenly has been house-trained all his life, and he starts to have accidents on the floor, and you take him to the vet, and the vet says, well, there's nothing wrong, I don't understand it. He could have canine Alzheimer's.
Hmm. So it's sudden change in behavior. How about you mentioned in your book runts of a litter maybe have a developmental shortcoming that can affect their behavior?
Yeah, that's another thing. So, you know, typical there would be what I mentally think of as like little white dogs, like Maltese. And they're very, very young. They haven't really had time to learn too many bad habits. And all of a sudden they start displaying some very bizarre behavior, and sometimes especially after eating, you know. So a dog like that might have, for example, what they call a portosystemic shunt or a liver shunt, and so the blood's not getting properly purified by the liver, and he's ending up by being sort of intoxicated by the toxins he's absorbing from his intestine, and that will cause a kind of a mind changer, an encephalopathy, inflammation, you know, altered function of the brain, which manifests as altered behavior. And that's kind of, it's too young for a dog to get into that kind of thing, and the timing's wrong. And so a number of, you know, things that just sort of flags that go up with the very young or the very old,
yeah,
or the sudden onset in the middle of life.
Is there a canine equivalent of ADHD, and how is it treated?
I think there is. Opinions are divided. You know, there are some veterinary behaviorists, fellow members of the American College of Veterinary Behavior, a college of the AVMA, American Veterinary Medical Association. There are a number of these specialists who would say, I don't know, I don't think I've ever seen it, I'm not sure I believe it exists, it's a will-of-the-wisp. There are others in that same college who would say they think it's very prevalent and counts for up to 30+% of all the behaviors that we see, and they treat accordingly. And then there's people like me in the middle who I say, I believe it does exist, it's really relatively uncommon, but not something you can afford to miss. But a lot of people mistake overactivity or hyper-reactivity, a dog being very reactive to sounds, for example, as being ADD. And ADD is much more sort of pervasive than that. It's throughout life, even when you're sitting watching TV and there's no one coming and there's no icicles dropping off the ceilings or whatever here in the Northeast, off the gutters. I mean, he still is a constant motion, has difficulty in focusing and so on. You know, somewhere along the line, you might suspect that, and the test is simply, as it has been in people, is to observe their response to a stimulant, any stimulant, you know, to, you know, whether it's Ritalin or coffee, and that the effect is calming as opposed to sort of accelerating, which it would normally be in a normal dog.
And you mentioned briefly about medications treating some of these anxiety disorders. Anti-anxiety medications, do they help?
They do, and it's funny how some people think animals can be anxious and others don't, but I took out a patent one time on the newly released human anti-anxiety medicine, Buspirone, trade name Buspar.
Sure.
And so I said, you know, I tried it in animals, and I put in a patent, and I said, here's an anti-anxiety drug for animals, that's a new thought. Patent examiner turned the patent down and said, it's obvious to one skilled in the art that an anti-anxiety drug that works in humans would also treat anxiety in animals.
Hmm.
He was obviously a patent examiner ahead of his time.
Now, Nick, I want to tell my listeners about your conference coming up. In March, Dr. Dodman will be right here speaking in Southern California, Pasadena, and here's your chance to attend one of Dr. Dodman's workshops. On March 26th, the Well-Adjusted Cat Workshop, Secrets to Understanding Feline Behavior, a one-day workshop. Topics covered will include social behaviors of cats, feline fears and anxiety, litter box strategies and scratching, feline compulsive behaviors, 7 steps to well-adjusted cats, feline medical problems that present as behavioral problems. Boy, if you listened to Dr. Dodman a few months ago on my show, we got so many emails just really loving your hour. I know they would love this workshop, this full-day workshop, March 26th. Being a cat owner, these are the things you just want to know about. Then what follows is a 2-day workshop, March 27th and 28th, the Well-Adjusted Dog Workshop, Secrets to Understanding Canine Behavior. Topics covered include dominance versus conflict aggression, separation anxiety, canine phobias, compulsive behaviors, 7 steps to a well-adjusted dog. You don't have to be an animal trainer or a veterinarian to attend this workshop. I would think any animal person would be interested in learning more about the natural behavior of their own pet. Gaining a better understanding in the ways our pets behave can only strengthen the wonderful bond and love that exists between our four-legged family members and us. Okay, so these workshops are held at the Pasadena Humane Society and SPCA in Pasadena, California. Again, that's March 26th through the 28th. And to register or get more information about them, log on to www.thepetdocs.com. You can always email me also, and I can repeat any of this information to you. Dr. Dodman, anything else you want to say?
I just think that it's great to be out on the road, which is what I am this year, talking to people in these locations, because it becomes, especially for very interested parties, I mean, I can talk to veterinarians, to vet technicians, to breeders or owners, and it's, unfortunately, behavior is a subject that everyone can understand, and I encourage, like, audience participation. People ask questions, we hang around afterwards, and I've heard it said people learn as much, you know, after and between talks as they do during them. So I've done some with my partner, Dr. Ian Dunbar. We did a double act last year. We've gone off on our own, and we're going to come back in 2011 for what we call a comeback meeting. But it's been a lot of fun. I think people learn, and it's really up to us, people like us, to spread the word, the positive word about how you can get goals accomplished without, you know, any inhumane treatment, without any, you know, choke chains for dogs or physical punishment. You can get everything you want by just rewarding the right behavior and no more than for something bad, just a little tiny scolding. It's just so fantastic, and I'm sorry that, you know, we don't have an ongoing TV show where we could sort of broadcast this out to the nation to help to correct things that are currently prevailing, you know, misinterpretations.
Well, maybe someday, and maybe someday soon. And Dr. Nicholas Dodman, author of the fabulous book, The Well-Adjusted Dog, as well as many other books he's written, thank you very much, sir.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, don't go away. We're going to learn about what's going on in Durville. Remember, we spoke about that a couple weeks ago in Thermal, California. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. This is Animals Today. Welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Animals Today sponsored by Desert Paws. Desert Paws is a nonprofit organization with its primary mission being education. Your donation to Desert Paws will help support the continuation of the show. www.desertpaws.org. Your donation to Desert Paws will also help sponsor a monthly Adopt a Pet ad in the Desert Sun newspaper. The ad comes out the last Saturday of every month for the past 10 years. The last Saturday of January will be next Saturday. The ad displays about 30 animals, dogs and cats, from our local shelters in the Coachella Valley. And these animals are desperately waiting to be adopted into a loving home. These animals were chosen to be displayed because they've been in the shelter the longest, and many, if not adopted soon, may be euthanized. Unfortunately, our country's shelters are packed and filled with wonderful adoptable dogs and cats needing a home. But because of the tremendous overpopulation problem, in which there are just too many animals and not enough homes, many of these animals will not even be given the chance to live. On average, close to 70% of animals that enter our country's shelters are killed. Isn't that incredible to think about, that we must kill millions of innocent, loving companion animals annually in our country? And the reason is because there's too many of them. We are killing all these animals because they had the nerve to be born in our world. And we are making the problem worse by not fixing our pets. And the breeders are selfishly making the problem worse by continuing to reproduce them. What can you do? Fix your pet and encourage others to do the same. And if you're considering adding a pet to your home, please consider adopting and saving a life versus buying a pet from a breeder or a pet shop. We are joined by Michelle Hodge. Now, if you were tuned into Animals Today a couple weeks ago, we spoke about Durville, which is a mobile home park in Thermal, California. It's been overrun by hundreds of dogs, unfixed, unvaccinated, you know, hungry, thirsty, not being well cared for, and just continuing to reproduce. So there's a lot of just exponentially increases in number, and a wonderful group of organizations and individuals went down there. The project started yesterday. It's continuing today to try to help these animals that are in need of help. And Michelle, you on the phone?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, thanks for calling in. We would love a progress report. What's going on in Durville?
Well, gosh, we're having a wonderful mobile spay and neuter clinic with vaccinations. Yesterday, we spayed and neutered over 85 dogs and cats, mostly dogs, and vaccinated. Many of them are homeless, and those that are homeless are going to be going to Save a Pet, and then they will be rehabilitated, they'll be readopted. Now, it's a wonderful community event. We've got over 100 volunteers. We've had many organizations participate, including Loving All Animals, Animal Samaritans, Save a Pet, PetSmart Charities, Humane Society of the United States, and many, many veterinarians that are donating their time. And this is a real, it's just, we're spaying and neutering out of the church in Durville, which is a double wide trailer, and it's just a wonderful situation.
So you fixed 85 dogs yesterday. That's great. You're vaccinating them as well?
Yes, as well. And if you were to see where I'm standing in about a foot of mud.
Oh, I
bet. We are doing the clinic again today. There are dogs running around, families bringing in six dogs, people wrangling stray dogs and bringing them in. We're giving $1 to each resident for each animal that they bring.
Oh, that's wonderful. The incentive
it's just
to get
wonderful.
Yes.
it's just a wonderful event. I mean, it's durable with the rains. It's a dirt RV park, so with the rains, you can imagine there's lakes, there's mud, and people are coming out and bringing these dogs. It's just really a nice event. And for those of you that are or that your listeners that would like to help, we are in need of food. PetSmart Charities has been nice enough to donate and feed the Duraville dogs for the past 3 months, but that has now ended. And these dogs that 3 months ago were skinny and malnourished now look healthy, but because that's ending, we are in need of people volunteering or donating either money or donating food to Duraville.
Okay, so if people listening want to donate some dog food, what should they do? Where should they deliver to?
They can either contact me directly at Animal Samaritans, and I can make sure that we either have a drop-off point or I can give them information on how to get to Duraville if they'd like to come visit. The park loves to have people visit. It's a really eye-opening to come see Duraville, but you know, things are changing slowly, but they are changing. But or they can visit Duraville's website. You know, the receivership that now is managing Duraville has its own website, and it's duraville.org, and it's D-U-R-O-V-I-L-L-E. And they can visit the website, they can see some pictures, and they can communicate directly through to the receivership to donate food, or you know, we can do it through Animal Samaritans, and they can contact me at area code 760-343-4271. That's my direct line at Animal Samaritans, and we can arrange drop-off points for food.
Michelle, is the group getting any resistance by the residents there?
Very, very little. Because some of the residents do just want their dogs vaccinated, but we're really doing a lot of education, and we are telling residents that the only way to get them vaccinated now or today is to get them spayed and neutered. And many of them are changing their minds, and they're going ahead and doing it. And it's really nice to see, you know, things progressing. And, you know, hopefully in a few months when we visit Duraville, there's not going to be all the puppies running around.
Right, exactly. Now, the project ends today. Do you think they're, because of the terrible rainstorm we had the last week or so, and I'm sure a lot of the dogs were stray dogs were in hiding, do you think there's still a lot there still in hiding that we're not going to get to today?
Well, I'm sure there's a few that we're not going to get to, but we will, you know, all these organizations were committed to resolve the problem, so we will be back. We'll be back with more vaccination clinics and probably more spay and neuter clinics. You know, the residents are getting to know us, and they, they're expecting us to come back, and they're asking when we're coming back. So I'm sure little by little, slowly and surely, with the help also of Pedro. Pedro, if anybody has read the Desert Sun articles on Duraville, Pedro is the resident of Duraville that feeds the dogs, and he's actually been helping us identify and locate and catch some of the stray dogs, because they know him since he's the one that feeds them.
Bless his heart. What a wonderful guy.
Yes, he's just great.
And so a lot of these dogs that you're not going to be able to, the homeless dogs, you're not going to be able to find shelter and homes for, will you fix them and just leave them there and Pedro will continue to feed them?
No, we're not re-releasing any of the stray dogs.
Good.
All of the stray dogs that come to us that we can get are all being spayed and neutered, vaccinated, and they are going on to save a pet. So also, if anybody's interested in adopting a Duraville dog, I have to say that they're very well socialized. For stray dogs, it's not, you know, you hear of these wild dogs out in Duraville, and they are strays, but because the way the community works, everybody walks everywhere, there's stores, there's a lot of movement on the streets, that these stray dogs are used to people, they play with
yeah.
the kids.
That Michelle, that's great. We got to go. Thank you so much for the update, and we'll I'll make sure we mention it again so people can go to Save a Pet also to see what the dogs are that you guys really went to the efforts to rescue.
Great, great. Thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you so much. This is Dr. Lori Kirshner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.